Welcome to this week's episode. For those listening, please do ensure you are in a safe space to listen to this episode, and I'm well aware that that almost makes it sound like it's going to be really terrifying, but I would certainly say the content in this episode is difficult, it's sensitive, and it discusses child sexual abuse imagery. We don't give graphic details of any of the images, but we do talk about the kinds of people who engage in collecting, distributing, sharing, and coercing children for this material. It's not the easiest of episodes to listen to, and I'm well aware that that can actually create quite a bit of shutdown in people when they're listening to this. And given that I write about and theorise around cyber trauma and the impact it has, I know that listening to this kind of conversation can also be quite harrowing. Please take care of yourself. Please make sure that you do not have this broadcast through speakers around children, because it really isn't a nice topic. There isn't any way to talk about this topic without being really truthful and talking about those difficult spaces. And that requires those of you who want to continue listening from this point to have some level of robustness, resilience, and capacity to listen to the most heinous kinds of crimes that can happen against children of all ages. And all of these children deserve us to listen and to do something about this. I know this topic is becoming more prevalent nowadays to talk about, and there are films that are being distributed, and the organisations that remove this material are now beginning to try to educate. And yes, often that does mean that they do talk about the material. So this episode goes into lots of different avenues about the process of child sexual abuse imagery online and how it's removed and what needs to change. It's raw, it's open, it's unpolitical, and Sergio is experienced for a long time in this domain. And it really is an episode that I invite you to listen to. And if you need to do it in short bursts, then please do. The same as I write with all of my books, please look after yourself and don't forget to breathe throughout the programme. So, welcome Sergio. And as I've just said in the caveat, today we're going to talk about a really sensitive subject. There are a number of these conversations that are going to take place. Today I'm speaking with Sergio. So why do you do what you do, Sergio? And why are we going to be talking about a really difficult, sensitive subject?
I think that the way that I bumped into this field was kind of random. Like 5 years ago, I went through a rough patch in my life. And I decided that I needed to do something for others, because the only way to help myself was to help others. And I was, back in that time, I was living in Belfast and decided to move to Dublin in Ireland. And while I was working for YouTube, I found out that there was a team that was called Child Safety, and I felt that it was my calling. I felt that that was what I wanted to do with my life. So I applied for the position and started working as a child safety analyst for Google through a third-party company. Like, for the last 5 years, I've been working in child sexual exploitation teams and working the ladder, like trying to do my best, so working as a trainer, quality analyst, team leader, to later on be scouted by a company that was based in Israel and move to intelligence analysis. Instead of working reactively for this company, I started working proactively, doing investigations for the same social media companies. Law enforcement response teams, investigations, research, gathering of information regarding predators, pedophiles, taking down content, reporting to the same companies. Mm-hmm. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the reason what I've been doing what I'm doing.
So, I mean, even at the outset here, we've got a few words which I think Maybe for the audience, we could look at def I don't even know if we can define them. Okay, so what you actually do is you work in the sector of what's now called trust and safety, but I heard child safety, child sexual exploitation. We're going to have conversations about child sexual abuse material, which during this episode might be shortened to CSAM, mainly because that's how we talk about it. But already I can hear that you were working in an environment that was reactive, so that will have been having the dire job of probably looking at and having to categorize and filter images and what that actually meant. And then you moved into a space where it was about preventing. So if we start off with, I mean, where we're going to go on this episode is going to be all over the place. So just to begin with, child safety. So how that was what, 5 years ago? So I'm just thinking of the terms child safety and where this began in terms of the internet and the vast connections where, excuse me, distribution of this material takes place. So do you want to start with what kind of work that actually meant in terms of child safety? So the reactive stuff, what do these companies currently do in terms of being able to keep children safe?
The way that social media work companies are working against child sexual exploitation, online child sexual exploitation, is with reactive workflows. Like they implement machine learning solutions, which means that they have algorithms that are crawling the web, that are crawling their platforms, and these algorithms are bringing content that they deem that it's considered under that threshold. What happens is that they work in collaboration with teams of human moderation reviewers. And these guys, what they do is they classify and label that content to feed it back to the machine learning algorithm so they can learn what they're seeing with computer vision. That means that once the content is classified, the machine learning model can understand better what they are classifying and therefore become more accurate. That's what it's called a reactive workflow.
So, I mean, given the landscape of where we are in 2023, so it's now June, nearly July, lots of people will have heard this term artificial intelligence. And if you go back, I can't remember what episode it was with Justin Sherman, and we talked about machine learning. So let's throw away that term artificial intelligence just for now, because the machine learning is pretty much, it says exactly what it does on the tin, isn't it? It's a process where you are giving the machine, the computer, you're giving the machine material from which it can learn. So many of you might have done one of those capture type programs where it's name, you've got to select, I don't know, traffic lights, bridges, buses, crossings. What you're actually doing in that process is giving the machines an ability to learn how we have those discrepancies as a human being about what a traffic light is and how we might classify it if it's in one of the corners of, the box. I know that people can get quite uptight over, do I click the box where there's just a little bit of a traffic light or not? And then what happens, and this is my understanding from my background in computers, is the machine is then able to classify what is and what isn't a traffic light. But in this situation, we are talking about the abuse. So it's the sexual abuse of children. And that sexual abuse might be carried out upon the child, or it might be a child doing something to themselves. And it might also be an image of a child who is semi or fully naked. Does that kind of explain? Do you think what's
That's
come out of
very
them?
much accurate. Like the classifiers that these models use are based in different categories. Like you go through different categories. Like some of these categories have been always publicized by companies like the Internet Watch Foundation. You have category A1, A2, B1, B2, which means penetrative activity or sexual interaction. And then you go through lascivious display. Then you go to sexualization of the minor, which it means more or less pedophilia. And then you go through other categories that the company doesn't want to be in their website, like, for example, CGI, which is now very trendy thanks to Gen AI and the Stable Diffusion models. But yeah, basically, it's just labeling the content so it can be understood.
And I don't know if computers will ever be as subjective and representative of a human being. And yet we have to start somewhere. This is what we've been doing for 27 years. I don't know why I've just used the royal we, but anyway, there's something about this is what's been happening for a long time, and the machine learning has had a huge amount of data. So we'll come to the numbers because I think you shared something the other day, and the numbers are, for many people listening, I think the numbers are going to be as representative as trying to imagine how big the universe is. That is how difficult it is to really take on board this
I would agree with
issue.
that.
Oh, it's stark, it's worrying. No, it's not worrying, it's more than worrying. It's absolutely catastrophic. So I'm not grandiosing that statement. I think this is why we're doing the conversation, Sergio, is so what we're talking about is these machines have had an enormous amount of data, and to try and describe and emphasize this for the listeners, those categories are decided upon the amount of harm that we are grading, so to speak, that's happening to a child. But actually, all of those images are collected by people, and those people are both male and female. Quite often, you will see in a lot of the literature, it is skewed in the direction of males, and it is skewed in that direction of the word that you just used there, which is paedophilia. So, first of all, for listeners, I wanted to explain that actually there are different age groups in which people have a sexual attraction to children. And some of the terms describe exactly what they are. So this is one of those moments where people may want to make sure that they do not have children in the background listening. But there is an infantophilia, there is a paedophilia, and there is a hebephilia. And one of the things that happens a lot in my clinic is young people will use the term pedo when actually they actually mean somebody who might be a hebephile or the other areas and other philias as they're known. And some people who collect these images are interested in what might be graded as low-level sexualized images of children. So let's just talk TikTok for 30 seconds. Children who are doing those, in air quotes, sexy dances as part of a TikTok trend might well be engaging in sexual behavior, sexual moves, what used to be what we called the MTV trend. So those children might be doing a dance that is suggestive, it's provocative, it's sexualized in some way, shape, or form. They might be wearing clothes that are considered to be collectible, if that makes sense. So it might be gym wear, it might be swimwear, it might, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It might be underwear. And then you have the people who collect that content and how that gets graded. So what we're actually talking about here are spectrums of behavior of the children who are encouraged, coerced, some children who don't even know that this is happening because they're doing, you know, a dance with their auntie, their mother, their friend, their sisters, their boyfriends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then there is the way that the machine learning classifies that information. And then that information is then collected and sent out to organizations to prevent the material appearing in the first place. Would that be fairly accurate?
I think that we have to understand something that is truly important here, and is that first of all, TikTok is a hunting ground for predators.
Yes.
Like the sexualization of minors that occurs in that platform, it's so widespread that you don't have to make an effort to find that content. And the thing is that algorithms in TikTok and in any other given platform, they are like pets. They can be trained. So if what you want to see is children in a sexualized way, dancing in front of you, and you are a pedophile, and you are really interested in seeing those children, you won't have any problem. That will be so easy for you. You don't have to make any effort.
So, I mean, this is the ooey part, okay? So as parents and practitioners listening to this episode, imagine popping onto TikTok and seeing the local primary school children, so these are under the age of 11, coming home from school, meeting up with their friends, and TikTok used to be called Musical.ly. So, you know, if you think about, so it's about music videos. Some of those songs are rap. Some of them are childish type voices. So I don't know if anybody has been on TikTok lately or whether they've watched any videos. But there is something about a lot of the songs are created to be what's called motherese, actually, in terms of the way that we talk to babies. So you might get a very famous pop song that then is given a bit of a child cartoon type voice, and children are drawn to copying their friends. And I'm just thinking, how many of us in the 1960s, 70s, 80s and 90s played skipping games where you would have a song and it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, or whatever tune it was, and you would do that in the yard, in the playground, and that would become something that all children would want to master so that they could join in the game and play. Well, take that and put it on the internet and emphasize it by hundreds of thousands of times, that these children want to learn these dances. Let's just take the floss from Fortnite for a second. If you want to be part of a group and be accepted by your group, you need to know these dances. And therefore, this is putting a huge pressure on these children to be on those platforms and watching the dances and carrying out the dances. And the pressure that I think the children feel, certainly the ones I talk to in the clinic, is they're then expected to post those videos on TikTok. So now imagine, as I was saying, all of those children under 11 that you know carrying out these dances and placing them on TikTok. Like you've just said, Sergio, those perpetrators who, I'm going to call it, get a kick. Okay, they get a kick out of watching these videos. It's more than a kick, but we're not going to quite go to exactly what the perpetrators are doing, because I think that would turn everybody off the episode. These perpetrators are then taking those videos, and they can collect them, they can go and watch them, they can follow those children. And I don't think right now we have the capacity to manage every single video that appears on TikTok. I don't think we have the capacity to manage every single person who wants to befriend a child or follow a child. And given that some of these platforms are public, and the way that you can go and just watch these videos without actually even having an account or labeling who you are, means that there's a lot of people who are continuously viewing these children. They may not even need to download and have those videos on their or images on their computer. So when we talk about the figures, which we're going to do in just a minute, those figures are underrepresented, completely underrepresented, because mostly we are talking about the figures that we know of that get reported. So if you just talk the figures for 1 second, Sergio, then we can kind of think about, well, do we triple it? Do we quadruple it? And again, this is a catastrophic epidemic, which is why this episode needs to happen, which is why we need to have these conversations, and why this is something people might need to go back and listen to time and time again in order to comprehend the difficulty that we currently face.
I think that there are several things that we can address here. One of them is that our mindset has to change.
Yeah.
We need to understand that we have to change our mindset and put ourselves in the shoes of these predators. Because unless we do that, we will never be able to tackle this problem. The second thing that we should address is the fact that if we don't start acting proactively, this problem will continue forever. Like right now, all the teams that are working, tackling the issue, they work reactively, but they don't have teams working within the companies trying to understand the issue, understand the trends, and do investigations before these things happen, working preemptively. And then the problem with the numbers, like you were saying before, like the problem with the numbers is that you have social media companies reporting, reporting content, and then you have leading warehouses like NCMEC or IWF filing those reports and referring those reports to law enforcement. And then you have law enforcement trying to tell the governments of each country that they should action those reports. The reality is that the disparity between what we report, what goes to law enforcement, and what is tackled by the governments, it's abysmal. Like, law enforcement is completely understaffed, overwhelmed, and they don't have the capacity. It's not because they don't want to. They really want to do it, but they can't because they don't have the budget or the resources. Yeah. And then you have these companies that are reporting that are telling them, you should do something about it. And then when they report, mostly are third world countries, the ones that have the highest number of reports, the ones that have less capacity to tackle those reports. So if you go to Germany, or if you go to the UK, or to the States, or to any first world, and I quote this because I don't believe in that, these first world countries, they have the resources, but they don't do it because they can't, because they are overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And then you have the countries that are most affected by those reports, which aren't able to do it and don't receive any help from anyone. Yes. So by at the end of the day, the reality is that from what you see to what is done, it's absolutely heart-wrenching.
I think that's an understatement, Sergio, in terms of the heart-wrenching. So what, I mean, we're not even talking infrastructure here in terms of it's that, I mean, it's so difficult to talk about this subject all the way through in just the way that we are. So if you are a third world country where, you know, your GDP is very low, you don't have the police officers, and I will make a point that so many people in conferences that you and I have been to over many years will say things like, we cannot arrest our way out of this, because what that means is just the services are overwhelmed. The infrastructure that we currently have is pretty much, if I go with your explanation of it there, somebody reports it to somebody else, somebody reports it to somebody else, and then nothing gets done. Or yeah, somebody reports it. Yeah, somebody reports it to somebody else. Somebody then develops a system, which we'll talk about shortly, in terms of the hashing and the way that we identify and then prevent. But actually, not every space in this internet, bearing in mind it is global, we have to think about this as global, borderless. Some of those spaces don't have the technological capabilities or the people to moderate and do something about it.
Tell me something. What is the point of developing new software detection tools or increasing the number of reports if at the end of the day nothing's done? What's the point? Like, why do we have so much capacity to develop these tools and these methodologies to then do nothing about it? Because we can't. Like, that's the reason why.
And that is a really hopeless feeling, isn't it? I am aware that certainly when working therapeutically, I do work with a lot of children who come from those spaces where it is hopeless. You can't, as a child, you often can't do anything about your situation because, you know, seven-year-olds can't decide to pack their bags and leave. I mean, I know a lot of seven-year-olds threaten to do that with a lot of parents, but there is something about a seven-year-old cannot leave a house. They cannot leave a residential setting. They can't go anywhere. And seven-year-olds are powerless in that situation. So are maybe 13-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 12-year-olds. It doesn't really matter what age. That powerlessness is because they are a child. And yet here we are as adults having exactly the same feeling about a subject matter that seems futile. It almost seems like there's nothing we can do. And yet we're trying to do something with the outcome of nothing's changing, or maybe something very tiny is changing. I wonder if we could even estimate, you know, how much percentage of this material gets taken down or is actioned and removed, and that child is then protected for the rest of their lives. I think the percentages would be low.
That's a really good question. Really, really good question. Like, I would never, like, the thing that when you've been working in this field for so many years, you realize that there's very little things that you can do. Like, the only way to push yourself forward is because you think that you are trying to help. It's not that you are trying to make a difference, because that sounds too grandiose. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that you do it because you've seen so many pictures or videos of these children being abused, that there's no other option. Like, for me, it's not a choice. Like, I promised myself many years ago that I will do this, even if I was in pain. And that's what I'm trying to do. Like, you don't do it for the big tech companies. You don't do it for organizations. You do it for yourself.
Yeah. So the people who, I mean, I do want to actually say the people who work in this sector are mostly, not everybody does, but mostly are exactly what you've talked about there. Mostly we all have that drive to try and protect children. What is happening to them is absolutely abhorrent. And I don't know if we could say that figures have changed since the advent of the internet. I don't know whether we could say it's because we now have the capacity to report more, whether there is now the ability for that material to be shared at a much faster rate. It's sadly ubiquitous in so many different places. And often, if I'm educating, you know, therapists or safeguarding teams, social workers and so on here in the United Kingdom, I cannot express to them how much of this material is what they call hidden in plain sight. This is not that. It's often dramatized, isn't it? Oh, it's on the dark net. Well, actually, no, it's not.
No, it's not.
And I know the figures. So if I just give some numbers, at the beginning of lockdown, there was a suggested report in this United Kingdom that there were 300,000 known perpetrators of crimes against children that were going to be watched because they now had more access to the internet. Children would obviously spend more time there. That figure I recently saw as 850,000. So I think, again, an underestimation, but those are possibly known perpetrators. Those are ones who maybe have been tracked or have a criminal record or on the sex offenders register. And then there's this thing about the unknown quantities. So do you happen to have in your head the kinds of numbers that you were talking about or that you shared the other day in terms of the increases in numbers, the increases in material, the increases in actual reports activated, followed up? And
so I do.
To talk the numbers a minute.
I do have the numbers. I don't have, like, I can't recollect exactly what were the numbers, but the disparity is so big that you would get a scare. Like, in a recent post that on LinkedIn, that I tried to explain what the disparity was, what I was explaining before and I mentioned previously, like, when you see how the gap is created between the social media companies, the law enforcement agencies, then the government's action in the content, the only thing that comes to your mind is, like, what's the point of doing this? Like, why are we doing this? Are we doing because we just want to whitewash the name of our company and to please our stakeholders in order to have a good public image? Or are we doing this because we really want to make a difference? Like, I found out very recently, and it's something that is really tormenting in me in my dreams, and it's the fact that lately, CSAN has become a product. Like, for many companies that are popping up on the field, it has become a solution to a problem which can benefit you as a company. And then for other companies and organizations, it has become the only way to live and breathe, thanks to grants and thanks to money that you receive from foundations. So I don't see many things changing in this landscape. The only thing that I see changing is that more and more people are interested in the field, but not for the good reasons. And that really concerns me.
Yeah. Oof. I mean, this is, wow. This topic is just, like I said, we would go all over the place, and we are doing at the moment. But this topic, my my own approach to this, and it's the reason why I write books and talk to people, and again why we're doing this, is I wonder if there's a huge deficit in terms of how we educate people about this. And I'm going to say one of the difficulties we have in this sector at the minute is I get the feeling, and I don't know if this is true, but I get the feeling from watching the reports that come out by those organisations that you mentioned. So we've got the National Centre excuse me, for Exploited and Missing Children, NCMEC, the Internet Watch Foundation within the United Kingdom. There's In Hope, that's a bit more broader than that. These organisations want the public to understand about this material. And I'm noticing that there is this feeling of, we've had enough, you need to hear what's happening. And because of that, it's what I call the shock and awe share. And what that actually does in terms of a human and their ability to even listen and take on information is when something is so distressing, you don't want to listen. And it's going to be really interesting, actually, to see the figures of the podcast listens after we've done this episode. And I would certainly say that people might come to this episode because they're interested. They might want the gory details. They might be hoping that we talk about what the images are in great detail. Some people might be interested in this for the what do I need to do? How do I manage this as a practitioner? You know, I also feel hopeless. Where do I go? What do I do? But there is this feeling that what's being shared at the moment in the public domain is far too detailed, far too distressing for people to be able to listen and make changes. I think we do a lot of finger pointing. Well, it's the tech companies that need to take it down. Well, actually, it's the parents who need to stop letting the children on their devices. Well, actually, it's the government who needs to do this. And sadly, when we get into this finger pointing exercise, it's a little bit like a circle with the children in the middle who are not being protected. And for
Let's start for something very basic. Let's start for asking a victim, what do they think about these posts? How do they feel with someone is describing something in so much detail that it hurts just to read it?
Yes. Yeah. And this is, I mean, this is why I didn't do much of that in terms of the book. Again, those, yeah. I mean, imagine, like, in fact, let's just address children and the varying ages. And the reason I want to do it this way around, Sergio, is something I think we said before we even started recording. There are children whom this happens to that do not have the capacity for a verbal recollection. And what I mean by that is children under the age of 5, they do not have the ability to recall and vocalize and disclose and talk to and explain what happened in their early years. We know that there's an increase of children, certainly between the ages of about 6 to 11, being recruited by these perpetrators to carry out some of this material. And then there are children who are slightly older who can do that. It doesn't really matter what age you are if somebody is talking about your trauma in a public space and explaining it, because some of those children may not be the one that's described in a report, for example. So it might be, I don't know, I'm going to go with Amy and Billy and Charlie, okay, because I generally go with ABC in terms of the names. So Amy does not know what happened to her, but has a bodily remembering, a bodily memory in terms of PTSD and trauma. And as Amy gets older, she reads some reports about things and kind of just feels like maybe there's not something quite right, or there's what we call a flashbulb memory. And that's still going to distress Amy as she grows up and moves into this arena, looking at and reading around some of these issues. And Billy might be a boy who remembers this and reads an account of another child, another Billy, and he identifies with that child. That is still going to impact Billy. And whilst I know that we have to have these conversations and we have to share what's happening to these children, we have to be very careful about when we're recounting victims' stories and what happens to them. And I think we've got too much into the weeds, as the phrase goes. I think we're beginning to share what's happening with the children, to the children, in the public domain. And actually, I think we need to address it's the perpetrators. So too often we do this thing where we make the children responsible, and it often gets called victim blaming. But I'm thinking here, we make children responsible for their own behavior, when actually it's the perpetrators recruiting, the perpetrators coercing, the perpetrators sextorting these young people to carry out some of this, these actions for that material.
I couldn't agree more, Kath. Like, I think that we have to change our point of view. Like, instead of taking into account the opinion and the feedback of people that have been victimized, re-victimized, abused, like, we don't do that. We just take the approach of the company, or we take approach of the public, instead of thinking how it's going to affect in the short term and in the long term these people. Like, I've been recently following a Substack from a person that calls herself Frida.
Yeah.
And she talks about the subject in depth, and it's amazingly accurate. Like, it's so good to understand the point of view of a person that has been submitted to online child sexual abuse, and now it's working in the industry trying to prevent those behaviors from happening. And it's refreshing, because we really don't pay attention to those voices, and it's a shame.
Yes, and there is definitely something about sharing stories, and I find that the victims are the ones who own that story, and the victims are the ones who get to share that story. So that there's a big difference between, and I have to do this in terms of when I was writing the books or case studies, and obviously in my job, it is, I get to talk to the victims about what it is that I might do, what I might say, what I might put into a book. And I talk about permissions, I talk about the impact, you know, so you might say yes now, but actually what might that be like in 20 years time if you then feel vulnerabilities around that? What would you, you know, because this is the thing about human beings, is they grow up, they mature, they change their opinions, they might feel empowered by doing something now, but not so much later. And I often say this, I don't tell other people's stories because they're not my stories to tell.
Absolutely.
And when I do share some stories, I obviously have to be very careful about victim identification, client identification. Sometimes they are vignettes where I have to take certain aspects of the stories out. And I've explained that in my book as to why I do that. And yet, in the fact that we're talking about this, the victims' voices are the things that we need to pay attention to, because that's really important. And I don't know how we can share this information with the general public, with the parents who are often unaware that this is happening, without A, blaming the parents, B, traumatizing them with the actual events. So do you have any ideas as to what this is a big question, isn't it? I've just thrown this one. Do you have any ideas how we could actually tackle this topic to change our mindset?
I think that the worst way to do it will be to consult with people that have been through these. Like right now, it's a very one-sided approach. Like, it's just what the company says. We follow the guidelines, we follow the policies, but we don't really take into account, like I mentioned before, the opinion and the feedback of people that have been through these, the people that are behind those images, behind those videos. Yeah. Like, yeah. If you were able to do that, if you were able to take these people and ask them straight away, like, what do you think? What would you do? What you wouldn't do? Like, those are the questions.
My head has just gone to a Lex Fridman podcast where I saw Mark Zuckerberg. Okay. And Mark, this was the first time. No, it wasn't. He was on Joe Rogan, I think. Anyway, one of those podcasts. And he actually said, now, the word we haven't used here is child pornography, because there is no such thing. Okay. Making that very clear. No such thing. And yet Mark Zuckerberg kind of hinted that there was none of that on his platform. Okay. Expletive alert.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's like when Elon Musk says there's no child pornography in my for sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is the state of where we are. And I quite often say to people, a third of the internet is pornography. That's adults, in that space doing what they do. And if that is true, that could often be an underestimation as to what the figures are for children, because a third of the internet users are apparently children, and a third of the internet users have access to those spaces. So a third of children, sorry, a third of the internet might actually also be this other material, which only leaves a third left, which isn't really a lot for Amazon, eBay, and all the other places that we go. And sadly, we're not tackling. I do feel, actually, when you said earlier about it does feel like, what's the point? This is helpless. And I don't know how we can change the mindset, because this is the subject nobody wants to talk about. Nobody wants to talk about children being sexually abused in this space, and those images and videos being collected by people, because that's what they are. They're collected, they're used as trading cards, they're used as monetary gain. People make a lot of money in this space on
They
this
do.
type of material. And the way in which, and I'm just thinking about whether I should share this. There is an episode in on a podcast called Sean Ryan. So it's the Sean Ryan Show, and he's actually talking to somebody who calls himself an ethical hacker. It turns out actually he's a vigilante, and what he does is he goes into these spaces and exposes the people who are looking for this material. And the language that he shares on that episode is not for the faint-hearted. So I am giving a caveat here. If you want to understand this space, you have to understand this is not a nice area.
Oh,
People
no.
say things about children which will make your toes curl and your stomach flip.
If you were in one of those forums in the dark web where they are sharing content and sharing material, you wouldn't believe it. Like, it's a very sad reality. And these people are normal, average people. We are not
Absolutely.
talking about depraved, evil demons. We are talking about the teacher in your school, your uncle. We are talking about the closest, the nearest and dearest. They are the ones. Like, people portray these predators like if they were from another world, and they are not. That's
Well,
the reality.
what I'll tell you what I did find, Sergio, so when I was working as a sex relationship educator, I'd go in, and one of the lessons, and I used to ask the company, don't do this, because it's not how it is. And they had this set of cards, and basically the cards would go around the room, and children would have to talk about relationships and sexual relationships. And one of the images was of a man sitting near a computer, and it was what I call the typical paedophile stereotype: beard, glasses, fat belly, sat in his underpants. And that is not the case.
No,
These
not at all.
perpetrators are exactly what you said. They are the people who walk among us. They're not zombies. They do not have a big neon sign above them saying, "I have a sexual interest in children." And children is such a broad landscape that I think one of the things we certainly can address in this episode, which again comes with a caveat, is that some of the children who appear in these images are children with disabilities, children who are tortured, children who are physically hurt, children who are drugged. This is not something that you would be able to tell by talking to a person. You might go to a meeting and look around the table around you, and of course this starts to skew your thinking if you're looking at everybody around the table and going, okay, so there's 12 people at the meeting. I wonder how many of them are sitting on an evening looking and searching for this material. I wonder how many of them have accidentally come across it, which, by the way, is probably the most used reason for people having this material. I accidentally came across it. And it's really, really interesting how we're not getting the mindset around these people live among us. These people are possibly in, I don't know, the local government. They're probably people that you pass in the supermarket. They're people that you will be sitting next to on the bus.
All walks of life.
Yeah.
All of them. Like, it's a reality that it's hard to grasp, but it's the reality that we face. Like, you see those people and the way that they are portrayed, like you said, it's very stereotypical. But then when you see the profiling of those guys, they are lawyers, they are in the government, they are in the police forces, in the military, they are in a grocery, they are butchers, they are plumbers, they are everything.
Yeah. And there is, there is this, I wonder if sometimes this is what we do. We idealize and stereotype. Well, it can't be so-and-so, so-and-so, because they're such a nice person.
I think that it's a way to shield yourself from a dark reality. Mm-hmm. It helps you to protect yourself and your mental health from what is going on. And that's what we basically do. We avoid this subject because we think that it's too dangerous for us.
Yeah.
So instead of tackling the problem, what we do is we really discard what we see or what we hear, and that doesn't help.
So I'm just going to double-click on that mental health thing. So people who work in this space, obviously, which includes people like myself that are working with the victims in a therapy setting, how do... So I know how I do my mental health, and actually I have provided training and workshops, and I've got another retreat coming up in August for people who work in this space, because what I'm seeing is the biggest level of PTSD, vicarious trauma, and what I've always called cyber trauma. I am seeing that is the biggest difficulty of working in this space. So not only do we have to change our mindset about this topic, we've also got this other area of, and how do we help the people that are currently in this space trying to make a difference, trying to do something, or whatever it is they have as their vested interest. How do we even manage this as a society? Because this is a dark subject. It's like the deepest, darkest hole, really, isn't it? This is a terrible place.
I'm really grateful that you are bringing this up, because in my personal case, I've been dealing with PTSD for almost 1 year. Like, I noticed the first signs of burnout a couple of years ago, but it wasn't until 1 year ago that I bumped into a video that really broke me apart. And that's something that big tech companies or law enforcement doesn't really know how to tackle, like the aftermath of what happens to you when you've been watching relentlessly these videos and pictures for a long, long period of time, mm-hmm. and what you've been treating with children that have been abused. Like, it's a sad reality, and I really don't have a good answer. Like, in my case, the way that I was dealing with it when I was working in the field instead of working pro bono like I'm doing now was just talking with friends that were working in the same field. People that I could identify with that were able to understand what I was going through. But right now, like, once you've left the field, it's very isolating. Like, that's the reality. Like, thanks to some friends that I have around, still can talk about what's happening to me. But it takes a toll in your life. Like, the way you see the world changes, the way you see people, and obviously the way you see children. Mm-hmm. In my case, if I'm around a school, if I'm around a playground, I get jittery. Like, I get really, really nervous.
Yeah.
Because I can't take off of my mind what I've seen. And it will accompany me for the rest of my life. And I know.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is where my foot in the space of cyber trauma, it really gives me that understanding, because... And I'm not going to go down the route of Jungian kind of spaces. One of the things that humans do is when they have an experience, they will integrate that experience in whatever way that their body will allow them to do and their mind allows them to do. And that's based on, you know, your upbringing, your childhood, etc., many more things. But also, you will then begin to extrapolate and generalize to that public space that you're talking about. So it really does skew your your thinking and your script and the way that you view the world. And that, I think, is the bit that's not necessarily understood in this sector. So there is also something about certainly understanding what trauma is and how it affects a person. And I know, so I'm just flicking through all the research articles in my head here. I know that the University of, is it Middlesex, CATS? The Child Abuse and Trauma Studies. They recently did some research around talking to some content moderators and said, you know, what is it that you would like? What is it that you experience? How do you manage? And there are spaces and words that get used in managing what we call vicarious trauma. Yeah. But there is something about this type of trauma is not fully understood in what I'm going to call the trauma space. And I'm saying that because, I don't know, maybe for a decade I've been going to conferences about trauma. And I am going to make this point here because it is in the book, the one that's due out soon. We talk about trauma. We talk about how to work with trauma. I am not hearing, I've heard one person, but I am not hearing as a generalized approach how we manage cyber trauma. The trauma greats are not talking about, for 27 years, people have been experiencing this kind of trauma in terms of the real world, the corporeal stuff, the children who experience it themselves. We're not talking about the fact that that trauma then appears online and affects that child and their family for a long, 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 long time. And I talked about this with Fred Langford in one of the other episodes. I think that's season 2, something like that. But we're not looking at what it's like to work in this environment for a long, long time and what that actually is for a professional who has to immerse themselves in something that is so difficult. It is, and there's a beautiful meme about walking through water and expecting not to get wet. You are in an environment where the kind of material that you're exposed to, and content moderators have to look at videos of torture, abuse, executions, as well as child sexual abuse material. Any of those has an impact on the body, which lasts a long time. And I haven't seen the right kind of what I'm going to call human care in this space, probably because services didn't, and this is, you know, how we do everything in life, isn't it? We didn't know what we didn't know. We didn't know that it affected people in this way. And we didn't know that this would have such a pernicious impact. And I think so often we don't necessarily understand what that means. And I know, I think in the CATS research, they talked about flow and blah, blah, blah. But again, people don't necessarily know enough about flow to be able to put that into a therapeutic space. I know that many of my colleagues are not working with this kind of material, A, because it's too difficult for them to listen to, B, they don't have the knowledge or connections to be working in the trust and safety sector. And this is the really privileged position I hold by one foot in the profession of psychotherapy and one foot in this world of technology and online harms and so on and so on. And I think that there is a huge gap across the world.
I concur with you completely. Like, I don't think that it's clearly understood. Like, once you've been working for these companies and you have experienced what you've been, they discard you are disposable. And they don't take into account the side effects or the consequences that it's going to have in your mental health in the long term. Because they are not interested. Your contract is finished. Therefore, they are not concerned about you.
I mean, yeah, it's huge, isn't it? People who work in law enforcement, people who work as content moderators, people who work in developing this stuff. And I suspect there's many other people who come across this, you know, maybe even a cybersecurity professional. So I've got an example here, which is a cybersecurity professional who was asked to look at somebody's computer because of the contents about thinking that the computer had been infiltrated. And it turns out that there was material on that computer, which they weren't ready to see, because who goes into a job thinking, I'm going to look at this computer? I wonder how many people have been repairing computers and actually this has been something that's been brought in, for example, on a laptop. And, you know, where do people go for that support?
I experienced something very recently. Like, I had a conversation with one of the big fish, one of the biggest social media companies. And it was kind of random because he was posting on LinkedIn something talking about mental health and content moderation on those platforms. And I just felt completely offended. Like, the way that he was idealizing the problem, all the measures that they were taking on the platform to tackle the content and to take care of the mental health of the reviewers was so offensive that I couldn't help but to just straight away text him and tell him, what you're saying is not real. Like, the distance between the reality of what operations is and tackling this content and what you're saying is just a romanticized version of what you see. And you are saying this just for one reason and one reason only, and it's because you have to talk to stakeholders and to the public, but you don't know the reality. You know what he told me? He told me that I might be right, but once your contract is finished, what is the responsibility of the company with you? Which, it didn't surprise me, it didn't shock me that he said that, but on the other hand, it shows you what are we dealing with here.
Yeah. And given that content moderators need, I mean, there need to be more of them in terms of the amount of material, because, you know, something that you mentioned earlier, which I'll bring in now, is that it's that computer generated stuff. And again, how do we as a society even keep up with the amount of material, the amount of content? So this is it's an impossible task.
Yeah.
But it certainly will require the recruitment of more people to help the machine learning and so, which means many more people are going to be almost brought into this area. And again, the thing is, Sergio, is I just find that idealistic thinking is a way that we manage. This is what we do with shame. So shame underpins so much of this topic in terms of we don't want to talk about it because it's difficult. And we don't want to talk about it because it brings up in us feelings that we don't know how to manage. I know that certainly I have never had to witness the images. I have had to listen to children. I have had to listen to conversations. I've heard so many talks about this in so many conferences with so many professionals. And I am angered. If I read about something, so this is kind of going back to the reports, if I read something, and I think it was the IWF report last year, I cried because the feeling that I had was anger and a lot of stuff, shame, anger, powerlessness, hatred for what was happening. I wanted to be an activist. It was all mixed into one. And that's a really difficult feeling for anybody to hold if they don't know what to do with that sudden whoosh of feelings, because not many people are, I'm going to say, educated, supported. My profession is very, very important to me because we have to have supervision. And in that supervision, I'm able to do what you did with your friends, which is talk to somebody who understands what's going on. The difficulty I've got, Sergio, is not many people in my profession work with this stuff. So I cannot.
Or want to talk about this stuff.
Well, it's the wanting to talk about it for sure. And certainly, you know, taking this content to somebody and saying this is what I have to deal with is almost like metaphorically. So I know it's not going to be visible for people that are listening, is you throw this shit on the floor in front of your supervisor and then you work it out together. And so often, people are taking this stuff, let's call it a feeling, this kind of, I don't know, big black ball, and they vomit it everywhere else, which is what I'm seeing on social media. This is, I can't handle this. I'm angry with it. I don't know what to do with it. So actually, I'm going to throw it at you in the hope that you will manage it for me. And this is something I'm seeing. I don't know, I kind of went a little bit psychoanalytical kind of into a therapy kind of conversation there. But there is this thing about being able to hold this stuff is difficult. So what we tend to do is put it to one side or put it in a box.
Yeah.
And nobody helps us deal with that box. And if you're talking about leaving a company and you've then got to take all of these boxes with you, you're pretty much carrying them behind you like a load of luggage.
You do.
And for me, that's the PTSD, that's the cyber trauma, that's what people are not being helped to manage. And I don't know how many people across the world are having to deal with it, but I certainly know that there's one approach that most people take in this domain, which is to desensitize, decategorize, and separate themselves from it. But let me tell you, that luggage is still behind you.
It will always chase you. Mm-hmm. It will hunt you like if you were a wild animal, I'm telling you.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would like to address something that you mentioned before, and it's the fact that we are seeing a nightmare coming, like with generative AI.
Yeah.
And what it's happening with text-to-image models, what we are seeing in this landscape is something that we are not prepared to deal with.
No.
Like right now, like the speed at which these applications and tools are growing, it's so fast that I don't see how getting rid of 95% of your trust and safety teams dedicated to child sexual exploitation is going to help to tackle this problem. We are relying so hard in AI and machine learning models to tackle the content and identify it, that we don't understand the only people that are able to understand the content are the ones that are behind the screen and can understand the nuances of what they're seeing, like the new trends, the new patterns, the new behaviors. That's something that AI is not able to do, because you are basically feeding those behaviors to the ML model.
Yeah.
And nobody's talking about that either. Like, we think that this is like the perfect recipe, but this is the perfect recipe for a disaster.
Indeed. And the bit that worries me, because I work with the children and the children are on the internet, is how much of this material is then going to become, what do I want to say here? How do I want to explain this? Without terrorizing everybody. So how much of this material is then going to appear in those end-to-end encrypted spaces, in child spaces? So I know that there are social...
It's already there, Kath.
Well, I mean, my thinking here, Sergio, is the number of children that get sent prank videos. So it's a video that gets sent. And actually, I noticed this morning. One of my friends sent me a YouTube video in Instagram. And I did that thing where I thought, spam, not spam. Click it, don't click it. And I went through this whole process of, okay, it's probably not anything sinister, because I have that trust in my friends. But if I was 11 and that came through and I was like, oh, it's from Charlie, I'll just click it. Actually, you could be sent to a video that is, you know, it could be one of those AI generated, it could be a real child. It doesn't really matter to the viewer who or what it is that you're watching. You are still impacted by seeing something happen to another person who's being hurt. And this is where cyber trauma started for me many, many years ago in terms of the term and the impact. Now, given that I saw that it was a YouTube link, I clicked it. And the first thing I did was I went to the hover space for where it's closed, because I know that if I needed to, I needed to click instantly the close button. Mm-hmm. Whew. Turns out it wasn't. It was a very lovely video. But I have that anticipation because I don't trust links on the internet at all, ever. And I've had this conversation with somebody on LinkedIn who sent me something and said, no, it's a gen link. And I said, I still don't care. I'm not clicking it. I don't know who you are. Oh, it's just a said. And I said, I don't care. If it's that, you know, innocent, put it on LinkedIn for everybody to see and tag me in the bottom of it. Oh, no, it was just a video for you. And this went backwards and forwards. I said, it's not happening. I'm not clicking it.
You've got to be really careful, really, really careful.
Absolutely. So I'm aware constantly that any link, any redirect, anything like that could take me to a space that I will never, ever forget. And that actually happened to me. I mean, when was it? 2014? I did an interview with a large therapy service, and I was talking about when Facebook started to autoplay videos, and I had no control, which was the bit that left me feeling powerless. And here we are, those spaces that children frequent, Snapchat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Out of plan. All of them.
Exactly. Because, I mean, recently there was some research done by Revealing Reality, you know, which talked about, now that's, for me, that's been going on for many, many years. And that's the daily makeup of the business in my clinic, is children talking about these videos and what they see and how it works. So for me, there's no surprise that these children see this. But what worries me is, in that space is going to be an increase in this material.
It will. It will. I can tell you that's very clear trend. Like, from what I've seen in the last years, like, the thing that really worries me is that whenever we professionals are talking about these subjects, like, they've been happening for years, and then suddenly someone from one government, it doesn't matter where they're from, or some organization, they raise the alarm saying, oh, CSUN is going to be created thanks to Gen AI, and you're like, no, it's not. Like, it's been happening for almost 1 year. Mm-hmm. Like, the thing is that you didn't know because you didn't realize, or because you weren't aware of it, or because any journalist created an article that was emphasizing that that was happening. But there are professionals that are already trying to tackle that problem. The thing is that you had the resources to do the investigation. These professionals have been trying to tackle the problem for mm-hmm. a long time.
Well, I mean, if I think back, I mean, just take Second Life, for example, right? So Second Life, you know, like when people talk about the metaverse, and I'm like,
yeah.
Number one, Red Dwarf did this many, many years ago, in terms of in the 80s, they had a TV series where they actually emulated virtual reality and the metaverse and so on. But here we are, we've had Second Life, we've had spaces where you can actually change your avatar, and this stuff has been happening for a long time in cartoon format. And machine learning isn't an invention that happened in the last 18 months, is it? You know, it's the ability to Photoshop. Oh, well, that's been around for a long time as well. So, you know, it's not this stuff is brand new. It's this stuff is now being talked about. And then we've got the spaces where this is going to probably appear a lot more. And I'm not going to talk about the metaverse, because I think it's an interesting word that's one of those rubbish words, a bit like, you know, life, in terms of, I think we've got many more conversations, and I'm just looking, we've been going for about an hour, so I'm just thinking, we've been all over on this episode in terms of the material, the kinds of people that look for the material, the kinds of processes that we do to remove it, and again, I think what we're looking at is, this is a reactive space at the moment, and you're trying to move into a proactive space. If we could sum up anything from this episode and this conversation, what do we want to leave people with?
We need to understand that in order to tackle the problem, there has to be big changes in the industry. In the industry, within the organizations, within the NGOs, all over the place. Like, what we are doing now, it's not working. But we keep telling everybody, and we keep patting our own backs, these conferences, webinars, seminars, saying that we are doing such a great job, instead of doing the job. And that's the main problem for me. Like, we have professionals that are trying to do their best, but they are completely isolated. Like, they have the help of very few people that really understand the problem. And I hate to say this, but those people that claim to be experts on social media, they are not. Because they wouldn't be saying what they do. They would be doing it.
Oh,
because as always, actions speak louder than words.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say that job is? What do people need to do? So what is the doing it?
First of all, I hate this word, cross collaboration.
Okay.
Because it means nothing. It's so empty, like real cross collaboration. Which never happens. It never happens. Even though they are saying this out loud in these forums, that it never happens. Real cross collaboration. And trying to understand that this is a problem that we are facing together. You can blame big tech, you can blame law enforcement, you can blame the public, you can blame anyone. You need to understand that you have to tackle the problem from the root of the problem. And understanding these new technologies is the very essence of what we are doing now, trying to understand how they work in order to prevent the problem from happening, which we are not doing.
Now I think that's because that's a very human problem. So I'm gonna do my tech cannot solve a human problem for a start off. And secondly, humans have egos and egos get in the way.
Oh,
in
yes.
Terms of, I would certainly say, now I did say this at a presentation one time, and one of my friends was like, wow, Kath, you just say it as it is, don't you? I actually said, put your egos down and put the children in the middle. Yeah. Because we are failing children, and children's development is being harmed. Not because, let's just make that a caveat, it's not because they're on social media and it's social media addiction and all that rubbish. It's because they are being sexualized and visualizing, witnessing, engaging in it. The whole space of child innocence has completely changed. And what we tend to do is we focus on something else and we call it addiction, rather than looking at the fact that children who are being sexualized, let's say 5, 6, 7 years of age, do not have that same level of parent-to-child interaction, child-to-child interaction that is innocent and joyful. It's become something where it's based around competition and, let's call it, the attachment to, I need to feel like I'm part of this new world, which is the digital space.
That ties into
self-esteem, attachment, all of the things that I kind of write about. But again, what we are trying to do is exactly what you said there, that point in, is we're trying to say, I've got the biggest, best company, or I've got the best technological intervention, or I've got, and the thing is that, as you said, cross collaboration is what we call multidisciplinary work. I can't even get that to work in my clinical practice, trying to get the teachers, the social workers, the police, and everybody to work together in terms, because everybody has their own policies and ways of doing things. And I think that's where we get it wrong, is we don't have a child-centered approach at the moment. We have a technological-centered approach, or we have, let's say, a law enforcement-based approach. And what we need is a child-centered approach. And that, for me, is the mindset that needs to change. If we put the child at the center of this and worked out what do children need, and that's not, I don't know, they need food and water, or they need a good environment to grow up. But it's the whole shaboodle. It's the entirety of that child's life. So when we look at what do children need, they need much more than we're doing at the moment. And sadly, I think that also falls into the space of, we make education a priority and not the social skills and the humaning of a little person growing up. We make it outcome-based and job-based and so on and so forth. We make it about the child's development to be able to succeed at employment.
I couldn't agree with more with you, Kath.
Well, I'll tell you what, thank you. But also, I've probably just put far too many opinions into this podcast, haven't I, in terms of... I really struggle sometimes watching... As you said, you know, those places where people say what they're going to do and then it not happening, or the fact that we all want to do the same thing, but we're all doing it differently.
It's not trendy to tell the truth. That's the reality. The trendiest thing is to say something and then not doing it.
I think that's an arse covering exercise, though, isn't it? That's about saying, well, we are doing something. This is what we're doing. Okay, that helps us feel better. And it reassures the public. And I think one of the things I'd said in one of the books is, far too long we've put our trust into these spaces, thinking that they'll be akin to education. So, you know, what we know is that when we drop our children off at school, we have an expectation the school will take care of our children.
Yeah.
And yet we know in those environments, children are bullied, children are sexually abused, children are rejected, they have lots of different things that happen. And we've done the same thing with technology. We've made assumptions based on our, well, the adults in the world will take care of our children.
but it's not their priority. Their priority is money.
Yes. Well, that's what I call, that's what I talk about, the profit over principle.
It's profit over well-being. That's the reality.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's, do you think that's the mindset that would change people's opinion? I'm just, we've gone off on a slight tangent here now, because I'm like, I wonder if people understood that some of these organizations do not have a vested interest in your child. So I talk about this one in the porn course. Porn industry is not interested in the welfare of your children. They are interested in the customer of tomorrow.
Of course. Like, I think that that's so obvious. Like, nobody cares about what you do or how it affects you. Like, they care about how to monetize your views. Like, the Center for Humane Technology talks very clearly about these things. And I think that it's open, it's eye-opening when they tell you reality.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, well, actually, let's just focus in on Center for Humane Technology. Do you think they address this subject enough? Because I think this is possibly one of the areas that, you know, it's that shame.
I think that it is spoken broadly, but they're not very specific with this subject. They come from a technology basis. Like, all of them have been working for these social media companies. And although they are trying to do their best to counteract the effects, the thing is that they earn their living thanks to them as well. And that's something that is worrying for me too. Like, I would like to think that everybody had their best intentions in mind, but that's not what I've seen for many years. Like, I always thought when I jump into this field, I always thought that everybody was doing their best to make the world a better place. But then I saw that that wasn't the case. I would like to think that that's gonna change. And I see good signs here and there, but it's mostly individuals that are doing their best.
Oh, that's so disheartening, isn't it? In terms of,
it's not for me. The way I see it is like this. Like, the way I see it is like, you need to have beacons of light in order to follow and to get inspired. Like, nobody's going to give you anything for granted. Like, nobody's going to be like, no, you know what? We are going to change things. No, you have to say it. You have to speak loud and clear in order for people to understand what's happening if you want things to change. So if you have just a bunch of people that are already being straightforward and trying to do their best to spread this message, that's more than enough for me. You don't expect the world to change just because that's wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
I just expect people to have values.
Yeah. Now, how do I end this without going? Well, humans have always humaned, and humans are not always necessarily 100% good. We have. I'm not going to say it's about the flaws or things like that, but actually, you and I know in terms of those numbers, and for people listening that are now coming to grips with this, there's a lot of people who do not have children as their vested interest in terms of well-being and development. Children are a commodity for some people for their own pleasures and expectations. And that is the difficulty of this space is, you know, people who might not have been interested in children in any way, shape or form may now be led towards that because of these algorithms and because of the way that we're not addressing this. The only service, actually, I will say that I do really like what Lucy Faithful is doing in this country, which is where they have the Stop It Now and they're trying to address this before it happens. You know, people who might type something in onto Google may get a pop-up that says, you know, it's almost like saying to people, do you really want to do this? Do you really want to change the way that you're going to be as a human being? Do you really want to go down this avenue? Because I think sometimes those conversations, you have that with children, don't you? If they're about to put their hand, I don't know, let's take a massive example here, that they're about to put their hand into a coal fire or on the hot radiator, There are parenting techniques. There's the one where you scream at the child. Doesn't change anything because the child goes, well, I'll do it when you're not watching. We have the kind of one that says, well, learn your own lesson, put your hand on it and get burnt. And then there's the parents that kind of have that conversation. Do you really want to do that? I've told you it's hot. And if you put your hand on that radiator, you're going to find out that I'm telling the truth, but you will learn you'll learn an experience. Let's just think about this. And sadly, that's what we're not doing. I don't think we're having conversations about what this could actually lead to. And I don't think people know that sadly, this is where it often gets mixed up with the blame culture of people who watch pornography then go on to that. That's not necessarily the truth. And that's not what research shows. But it is one of the ways that we can say, oh, well, it's the porn industry's fault.
It's so easy to blame. It's really easy instead of understanding like the whole spectrum of what's happening. Mm. Like there are so many factors to take into account when it comes to understand the equation that it's creating all this content.
Mm-hmm. And for listeners, that was one of those kind of powerless head shakes that you did then, as if so. So at the end of the episode, we haven't really got anywhere, have we, in terms of apart from we've talked about the issue. We've talked about there are things that need to be done. I know that certainly there's an increase that I'm watching at the moment in the numbers of these vigilantes that are taking this into their own hands because people are getting fed up, you know, and that's because, as you've said, the things being done to protect children are not happening in the way that's effective enough.
It's true. Like, I'm a bit scared about these vigilantes because sometimes they get into investigations in which they are trying to undercover, working undercover, like law enforcement, to just see if there's networks that are connected to different platforms. And that's something that I've seen before as well. But I understand the feeling. I understand the frustration. And I understand what they're doing.
And certainly that was what I noticed in terms of the feeling I had when I watched that Sean Ryan podcast, was that vigilante, the road to hell is paved with best intentions. Actually, that vigilante could have scuppered so many proper law enforcement investigations. Yes. And sadly, you know, people do get things wrong. There's another thing about, you know, the way that we talk about people and actually what would happen if somebody made a false allegation and then what happens from, again, it is a space where law enforcement are best left to investigate these things. And I think it's that frustration and wanting to do the right thing that makes that area then muddied and difficult, doesn't it?
I understand the point of view of a person that is seeing how these things are developing and wants to help. Mm-hmm. But trust me, they are not helping because they are maybe tampering with an investigation that it's already ongoing. And they are trying to just recover information. They are gathering information for all these accounts, for all these profiles. And suddenly you think that you are helping because you are discovering one profile that it's looking for season. But instead of doing that, what you're doing is just raising the alarm to the whole community that is looking for season. And these are 500 people. Mm-hmm. So please take my word for sure. Like, don't do that.
It's what I used to call the people that would go to the party and go, by the way, the police are on their way. So everybody goes.
Pretty much.
You're not really helping. Mm-hmm. Right, I am going to stop our pause for there, and obviously I think one of the things to say is thank you for anybody who has made it this far through the conversation. It's not easy. I am going to have another conversation with somebody who's another colleague of ours, and again, because I think this needs tackling, talking about, and different people have different opinions and so on and so forth. But thank you so much for your time today, Sergio.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.